Chapter 3. A faith in man's destiny and the supremacy of good, which has too long been silenced by the whining chorus of a decadent nihilism. It is well, the writer continued, when such reminders come to us not from the moralist, but from the man of science, when from the desiccating atmosphere of the laboratory there rises this glorious cry of faith and reconstruction. The review was minute and exhaustive. Thanks no doubt to Harvis's diplomacy, it had been given to the investigator's S-man, and the professor was startled by the bold eye with which his emancipated fallacies confronted him. Under the reviewer's handling they made up admirably as truths, and their author began to understand Harvis's regret that they should be used for any less profitable purpose. The investigator, as Harvis phrased it, set the pace, and the other journals followed, finding it easier to let their critical man of all work play a variation on the first reviewer's theme than to secure an expert to owe the book afresh. But it was evident that the professor had captured his public, for all the resources of the profession could not, as Harvis gleefully pointed out, have carried the book so straight to the heart of the nation. There was something noble in the way in which Harvis belittled his own share in the achievement, and insisted on the inutility of shoving a book which had started with such headway on. All I ask you is to admit that I saw what would happen, he said with a touch of professional pride. I knew you'd struck the right note. I knew they'd be quoting you from Maine to San Francisco. Good as fiction? It's better it'll keep going longer. Will it? Said the professor with a slight shudder. He was resigned to an ephemeral triumph, but the thought of the book's persistency frightened him. I should say so. Why, you fit in everywhere science, theology, natural history and then the all for the best element which is so popular just now. Why, you come right in with the How to Relax series, and they sell way up in the millions. And then the book's so full of tenderness, there are such lovely things in it about flowers and children. I didn't know an old dryasdist like you could have such a lot of sentiment in him. Why, I actually caught myself sniveling over that passage about the snowdrops piercing the frozen earth. And my wife was saying the other day that, since she's read the vital thing, apostrophe, she begins to think you must write the what cheer column, apostrophe in the England book. He threw back his head with a laugh which ended in the inspired cry, colon, and, by George, sir, when the thing begins to slow off we'll start somebody writing against it, and that will run us straight into another 100,000. And as earnest of this belief he drew the professor a supplementary check. V. Mrs. Linyard's knock cut short the importunities of the lady who had been trying to persuade the professor to be taken by flashlight at his study table for the Christmas number of the England Book. On this point the professor had fancied himself impregnable, but the unwonted smile with which he welcomed his wife's intrusion showed that his defenses were weakening. The lady from the England Book took the hint with professional promptness, but said brightly, as she snapped the elastic around her notebook, colon, I shan't let you forget me, Professor. The groan with which he followed her retreat was interrupted by his wife's question, colon, do they pay you for these interviews, Samuel? The professor looked at her with sudden attention. And not directly, he said, wondering at her expression. She sank down with a sigh. I indirectly, then? What is the matter, my dear? I gave you Harvis's second check the other day, her tears arrested him. Don't be hard on the boy, Samuel. I really believe your success has turned his head. The boy, what boy? My success? Explain yourself, Susan. It's only that Jack has borrowed some money which he can't repay. But you mustn't think him altogether to blame, Samuel. Since the success of your book he has been asked about, so much it's given the children quite a different position. Millicent says that wherever they go the first question asked is, are you any relation of the author of The Vital Thing? Apostrophe, apostrophe, of course we're all very proud of the book, but it entails obligations which you may not have thought of in writing it. The professor sat gazing at the letters and newspaper clippings on the study table which he had just successfully defended from the camera of the Inglenook. He took up an envelope bearing the name of a popular weekly paper. "I don't know that the Inglenook would help much," he said, "but I suppose this might." Mrs. Linyard's eyes glowed with maternal avidity. "What is it, Samuel?" "A series of scientific sermons for the Round the Gas Log column of the Woman's World. I believe that journal has a larger circulation than any other weekly, and they pay in proportion." He had not even asked the extent of Jack's indebtedness. It had been so easy to relieve recent domestic difficulties by the timely production of Harvest's two checks, that it now seemed natural to get Mrs. Linyard out of the room by promising further reinforcements. The professor had indignantly rejected Harvest's suggestion that he should follow up his success by a second volume on the same lines. He had sworn not to lend more than a passive support to the fraud of The Vital Thing, but the temptation to free himself from Mrs. Linyard prevailed over his last scruples, and within an hour he was at work on the scientific sermons. The professor was not an unkind man. He really enjoyed making his family happy, and it was his own business, if his reward for so doing was that it kept them out of his way. But the success of The Vital Thing gave him more than this negative satisfaction. It enlarged his own existence and opened new doors into other lives. The professor, during 50 virtuous years, had been cognizant of only two types of women. The fond and foolish, whom one married, and the earnest and intellectual, whom one did not. Of the two, he infinitely preferred the former, even for conversational purposes. But as a social instrument, woman was unknown to him, and it was not till he was drawn into the world on the tide of his literary success that he discovered the deficiencies in his classification of the sex. Then he learned with astonishment of the existence of a third type, the woman who is fond without foolishness and intellectual without earnestness. Not that the professor inspired, or sought to inspire, sentimental emotions, but he expanded in the warm atmosphere of personal interest which some of his new acquaintances contrived to create about him. It was delightful to talk of serious things in a setting of frivolity, and to be personal without being domestic. Even in this new world, where all subjects were touched on lightly, and emphasis was the only indelicacy, the professor found himself constrained to endure an occasional reference to his book. It was unpleasant at first, but gradually he slipped into the habit of hearing it talked of, and grew accustomed to telling pretty women just how tea had first come to him. Meanwhile, the success of the scientific sermons was facilitating his family relations. His photograph in the Inglenook, to which the lady of the notebook had succeeded in appending a vivid interview, carried his fame to circles inaccessible even to The Vital Thing, and the professor found himself the man of the hour. He soon grew used to the functions of the office, and gave out $100 interviews on every subject, from labor strikes to babism, with a frequency which reacted agreeably on the domestic exchequer. Presently his head began to figure in the advertising pages of the magazines. Admiring readers learned the name of the only breakfast food in use at his table, of the ink with which The Vital Thing had been written, the soap with which the author's hands were washed, and the tissue builder which fortified him for further effort. These confidences endeared the professor to millions of readers, and his head passed in due course from the magazine and the newspaper to the biscuit tin and the chocolate box. The professor, all the while, was leading a double life. While the author of The Vital Thing reaped the fruits of popular approval, the distinguished microscopist continued his laboratory work unheeded save by the few who were engaged in the same line of investigations. His divided allegiance had not hitherto affected the quality of his work. It seemed to him that he returned to the laboratory with greater zest after an afternoon in a drawing room, where readings from The Vital Thing had alternated with plantation melodies and tea. He had long ceased to concern himself with what his colleagues thought of his literary career. Of the few whom he frequented, none had referred to the vital thing, and he knew enough of their lives to guess that their silence might as fairly be attributed to indifference as to disapproval. They were intensely interested in the professor's views on beetles, but they really cared very little what he thought of the Almighty. The professor entirely shared their feelings, and one of his chief reasons for cultivating the success which accident had bestowed on him was that it enabled him to command a greater range of appliances for his real work. He had known what it was to lack books and instruments, and the vital thing was the magic wand which summoned them to his aid. For some time he had been feeling his way along the edge of a discovery. Balancing himself with professional skill on a plank of hypothesis flung across an abyss of uncertainty. The conjecture was the result of years of patient gathering of facts. Its corroboration would take months more of comparison and classification. But at the end of the vista, victory loomed. The professor felt within himself that assurance of ultimate justification which, to the man of science, makes a lifetime seem the mere comma between premise and deduction. But he had reached the point where his conjectures required formulation. It was only by giving them expression, by exposing them to the comment and criticism of his associates, that he could test their final value, and this inner assurance was confirmed by the only friend whose confidence he invited. Professor Peace, the husband of the lady who had opened Mrs. Linyard's eyes to the triumph of the vital thing, was the repository of her husband's scientific experiences. What he thought of the vital thing had never been divulged, and he was capable of such vast exclusions that it was quite possible that pervasive work had not yet reached him. In any case, it was not likely to affect his judgment of the author's professional capacity. "You want to put that all in a book, Linyard," was Professor Peace's summing up. "I'm sure you've got hold of something big, but to see it clearly yourself you ought to outline it for others. Take my advice, chuck everything else, and get to work tomorrow. It's time you wrote a book, anyhow. It's time you wrote a book, anyhow." The words smote the professor with mingled pain and ecstasy. He could have wept over their significance. But his friend's other phrase reminded him with a start of Harvest. "Why, you have got hold of a big thing," it had been the publisher's first comment on the vital thing. But what a world of meaning lay between the two phrases. It was the world in which the powers who fought for the professor were destined to wage their final battle, and for the moment he had no doubt of the outcome. The next day he went to town to see Harvest. He wanted to ask for an advance on the new popular edition of The Vital Thing. He had determined to drop a course of supplementary lectures at the university, and to give himself up for a year to his book. To do this, additional funds were necessary, but thanks to The Vital Thing they would be forthcoming. The publisher received him as cordially as usual, but the response to his demand and was not as prompt as his previous experience had entitled him to expect. "Of course we'll be glad to do what we can for you, Linyard, but the fact is, we've decided to give up the idea of the new edition for the present." "You've given up the new edition?" "Why, yes, we've done pretty well by The Vital Thing, apostrophe, and we're inclined to think it's your turn to do something for it now." The professor looked at him blankly. "What can I do for it?" he asked Hatmore, his accent added. "Why, put a little new life in it by writing something else. The secret of perpetual motion hasn't yet been discovered, you know, and it's one of the laws of literature that books which start with a rush are apt to slow down sooner than the crawlers. We've kept The Vital Thing going for 18 months. But, hang it, it ain't so vital anymore. We simply couldn't see our way to a new edition. Oh, I don't say it's dead yet, but it's moribund, and you're the only man who can resuscitate it." The professor continued to stare. What can I do about it?" he stammered. "Do? Why, write another like it, go it one better. You know the trick. The public isn't tired of you by any means, but you want to make yourself heard again before anybody else cuts in. Write another book, write two, and we'll sell them in sets in a box. The Vital Thing series. That will take tremendously in the holidays. Try and let us have a new volume by October. I'll be glad to give you a big advance if you'll sign a contract on that. The professor sat silent. There was too cruel an irony in the coincidence. Harvis looked up at him in surprise. Well, what's the matter with taking my advice? You're not going out of literature, are you? The professor rose from his chair. And no, I'm going into it, he said simply. Going into it? I'm going to write a real book, a serious one. Good Lord. Most people think The Vital Thing is serious. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.